If steel demand had softened at this precarious point, Fontana might have floundered. Instead, a big transcontinental gas pipeline deal provided Kaiser Steel with invaluable collateral, while the sudden outbreak of the Korean War revived the West Coast shipbuilding industry. Following the advice of the Giannini family, who also extended Fontana's credit, Kaiser made his steel operations public. The Los Angeles business elite, led by Times heir Norman Chandler, who became a Kaiser Steel director, and old friend John McCone, rallied to the initial stock offering, allowing Henry J. to retire the RFC loan in 1950. With increased access to private capital, and with the Southern California market booming beyond all expectations, Kaiser Steel expanded and diversified. Two post-war expansions added a second blast furnace, as well as new tin plate, strip, and pipe mills. A revolutionary pelletizing plant was installed at Eagle Mountain, and in 1959, Governor Brown joined Henry J. for the dedication of a state-of-the-art basic oxygen furnace. With a workforce of 8,000 and plans on the drawing board for doubling capacity, Kaiser Steel was a national midget, but a regional giant. In 1962, in a move that was a big step in the direction of eliminating that historic phrase, prices slightly higher west of the Rockies, Kaiser Steel sharply reduced its prices. Eastern Steel was virtually driven from the market, leaving Fontana, together with U.S. Steel at Geneva, to co-monopolize the Pacific Slope. Equally reassuring, Kaiser Steel seemed to continue in the forefront of enlightened industrial relations. Although, unlike in 1946, Fontana was closed down during the long 1959 steel strike, it broke ranks with Big Steel to embrace the United Steelworkers' proposals for a gains-sharing plan to integrate technological change into the collective bargaining framework. First, a tripartite committee with a public member was established to study conflicts between local work rules and the introduction of automation. Then, in 1963, the company and union, with considerable ceremony, formalized the landmark long-range sharing plan, loosely based on the so-called Scanlon Plan, whose complex formulae and provisions were supposed to fairly compensate workers for accepting rapid productivity advance. The plan, whose original backers had included the elite of academic industrial relations specialists and two future secretaries of labor, Goldberg and Dunlop, became the Kennedy administration's prototype for new frontier-era collective bargaining, and was soon cited as such in every industrial relations textbook. This was the golden age of Kaiser Steel, Fontana, flagship of the West's post-war smokestack economy. Neither the captain on the deck nor the crew below could see the economic icebergs ahead. Holocaust in Fontana. Whites from the South compose the majority of the population of Fontana. They have brought to that community their backward community mores, their hate-mongering religious cults. O'Day Short, murdered by Fontana vigilantes, 1946. For hundreds of Dust Bowl refugees from the Southwest, still working in the orchards at the beginning of World War II, Kaiser Steel was the happy ending to the Grapes of Wrath. Construction of the mill drained the San Bernardino Valley of workers, creating an agricultural labor shortage that was not relieved until the coming of the Braceros in 1943. Kaiser originally believed that he could apply his Richmond methods to shaping the Fontana workforce, leaving the construction crews in place and training them in 10 days to make steel under the guidance of experts hired from the East. But he underestimated the craft, knowledge, and folklore, only communicated through hereditary communities of steelworkers, that were essential to making steel. Urgent appeals, therefore, were circulated through the steel valleys of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, recruiting draft-exempt steel specialists for Fontana. The impact of 5,000 steelworkers and their families on local rusticity was predictably shattering. The available housing stock in Fontana and western San Bernardino County, also coveted by incoming military families, was quickly saturated. With few zoning ordinances to control the anarchy, temporary and substandard shelters of every kind sprouted up in Fontana and neighboring districts like Rialto, Bloomington, and Cucamonga. Most of the original blast furnace crew was housed in a jerry-built trailer park known affectionately as Kaiserville. Later arrivals were often forced to live out of their cars. The old Fontana Farms colonists came under great pressure to sell to developers and speculators. Others converted their chicken coops to shacks and rented them to single workers, a primitive housing form that was still common through the 1950s. Although areas of Fontana retained their Malarian charm, especially the red-tiled village center along Sierra, with its Art Deco theater and prosperous stores, boisterous, often rowdy juke joints, and roadhouses, created a different ambiance along Arrow Highway and Foothill Boulevard. Neighboring Rialto, presumably the location of Eddie Mars's casino and Chandler's The Big Sleep, acquired a notorious reputation as a wide-open gambling center and L.A. mob hangout, a reputation it has recovered in the 1990s as the capital of the Inland Empire's crack gangs. Meanwhile, the ceaseless truck traffic from the mill, together with the town's adjacency to Route 66, and today to Interstates 10 and 15, made Fontana a major regional trucking center, with bustling 24-hour fuel stops and cafes on its outskirts. Boomtown Fontana of the 1940s ceased to be a coherent community or cultural fabric. Instead, it was a colorful but dissonant bricolage of sun-kissed growers, Slovene chicken ranchers, gamblers, mobsters, over-the-road truckers, industrialized Okies, braceros, the Army Air Corps, at nearby bases, and transplanted steelworkers and their families. It was also a racial frontier where black families tried to stake out their own modest claims to a ranch home or a job in the mill. Although, as war in the Pacific was ending, there was an optimistic aura of sunshine and prosperity in the western San Bernardino Valley, there were also increasing undertones of bigotry and racial hysteria. Finally, just before Christmas Eve 1945, there was atrocity. The brutal murder and its subsequent official cover-up of O'Day Short, his wife, and two small children indelibly stamped Fontana, at least in the eyes of black Californians, as being violently below the Mason-Dixon line. Ironically, Fontana had been one of the few locations in the Citrus Belt where blacks had been allowed to establish communities. Every week during the 1940s, the Eagle, Los Angeles's progressive black paper, carried prominent ads for sunny, fruitful lots in the Fontana area. For pent-up residents of the overcrowded Central Avenue ghetto, prevented by restrictive covenants, L.A. Jim Crow, from moving into suburban areas like the San Fernando Valley, Fontana must have been alluring. Moreover, Kaiser's Richmond shipyards were the biggest employer of black labor on the coast, and there was widespread hope that his new steel plant would be an equally colorblind employer. The reality in Fontana was that blacks were segregated in their own tracts, a kind of citrus ghetto on the rocky floodplain above Baseline Avenue in vaguely delineated North Fontana. Meanwhile, in the mill, blacks and Chicanos were confined to the dirtiest apartments, coke ovens and blast furnaces, a situation unchanged until the early 1970s. O'Day Short, already well known in Los Angeles as a civil rights activist, was the first to challenge Fontana's residential segregation by buying land in town, on Randall Street, in fall 1945. Short's move coincided with the Ku Klux Klan's resurgence throughout Southern California, as white supremacists mobilized to confront militant returning black and Chicano servicemen. In early December, Short was visited by vigilantes, probably Klansmen, who ordered him to move or risk harm to his family. Short stood his ground, reporting the threats to the FBI and the county sheriff, as well as alerting the black press in Los Angeles. Instead of providing protection, sheriff's deputies warned Short to leave before any disagreeableness happened to his family. The Fontana Chamber of Commerce, anxious to keep blacks above baseline, offered to buy Short out. He refused. A few days later, on the 16th of December, the Short house was consumed in an inferno of unusual intensity. Neighbors reported hearing an explosion, then seeing blobs of fire on the ground, and the family running from their home with clothes ablaze. Short's wife and small children died almost immediately. Unaware of their deaths, he lingered on for 2 weeks in agony. According to one account, Short finally died after being brutally informed by the district attorney of his family's fate. The DA was later criticized for breaking the hospital's policy of shielding Short from further trauma. The local press gave the tragedy unusually low-key coverage, quoting the DA's opinion that the fire was an accident. that a coroner's inquest was held at all on the 3rd of April 1945 was apparently due to pressure from the NAACP and the black press. Contrary to standard practice in such cases, District Attorney Jerome Kavanaugh refused to allow witnesses to testify about the vigilante threats to the Short family. Instead, Kavanaugh read into the record the interview he had conducted with Short in the hospital, in which the sick man repeatedly said he was too ill and upset to make a statement, but yielded to steady pressure and suggestion by finally saying that the fire seemed accidental as far as he was concerned. Fontana fire officials, conceding they had no actual evidence, speculated that the Holocaust might have been the result of a kerosene lamp explosion. The coroner's jury, deprived of background about the vigilante threats, accordingly ruled that the Shorts had died from a fire of unknown origin. The sheriff declined an arson investigation. The black community in Fontana, many of whom themselves had been admonished by Deputy Sheriff Tex Carlson to advise the Shorts to get out, were unanimous in rejecting the accident theory. Fontana's most famous black resident, Shelton Brooks, composer of the Darktown Strutters Ball, demanded a full-scale arson investigation. J. Robert Smith, crusading publisher of the Tri-County Bulletin, the black paper serving the Inland Empire, decried an official cover-up of mass murder, a charge echoed by Short's friends Joseph and Charlotta Bass, publishers of the Los Angeles Eagle. The case became a brief national cause célèbre after the Los Angeles NAACP, led by Lorenzo Bowden, hired renowned arson expert Paul T. Wolfe to sift through the evidence, noting that the supposed cause of the fire, the kerosene lamp, had actually been recovered intact. He found compelling evidence that the Short home had been deliberately soaked in quantities of coal oil to produce an explosive blaze of maximum ferocity. He concluded that, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the fire was of an incendiary origin. In the meantime, the Tri-County Bulletin discovered that the original sheriff's report on the fire had mysteriously disappeared from its file, while the Eagle raised fundamental doubts about Short's purported testimony to D.A. Kavanaugh. Mass demonstrations were held in San Bernardino and Los Angeles, as scores of trade union locals, progressive Jewish organizations, and civil rights groups endorsed the NAACP's call for a special investigation of lynch terror in Fontana by California's liberal attorney general, Robert Kenney, another Gunther favorite. Catholic interracial council leader Dan Marshall pointed out that murder is the logical result of discrimination, while communist leader Pettus Perry described the Short case as the most disgraceful that has ever occurred in California. But it was hard to keep the Short Holocaust in focus. Attorney General Kenney succeeded in temporarily banning the Ku Klux Klan in California, but made no attempt to reopen investigation into the Short case or expose the official whitewash by San Bernardino officials. The Los Angeles NAACP spearhead of the campaign quickly became preoccupied with a renewed struggle against housing discrimination in south-central Los Angeles. The Trotskyist Socialist Workers' Party continued its own sectarian campaign through the spring of 1946, but used the Short case primarily to polemicize against Kenney, Democratic nominee for governor, and his communist supporters. In the end, as protest faded, the vigilantes won the day. Blacks stayed north of Baseline, and in the coke ovens, for another generation, and the fate of the Short family, likely victims of white supremacy, was officially forgotten. However, early post-war Fontana found it difficult to avoid notoriety. If the press downplayed the Short case, it sensationalized the murder trial of Gwendolyn Wallace, a local policeman's wife who confessed to shooting her husband's mistress, a pretty young Fontana schoolteacher named Ruby Clark. At a time when countless Hollywood films in the Joan Crawford vein were beginning to sermonize against wartime morals and gender equality, the Wallace trial became a lightning rod for contending values. Girls argued with their mothers, husbands fought with wives, marriages reportedly even broke up over Gwendolyn's justification for killing Ruby, that she was a scheming single working woman. Her surprise acquittal in March 1946 was greeted across the country with both anger and celebration. At the courthouse in San Bernardino, she was mobbed by sympathetic women, mostly long-suffering housewives like herself who had become her adoring fans in the course of this real-life soap opera. Finally, to permanently reinforce the new Fontana's wild image, 1946 was also the year that the original nucleus of the Hell's Angels began to coalesce in the area. According to legend, the founders were demobbed bomber crewmen right out of the pages of Heller's Catch-22, who rejected the return to staid civilian lives. Whatever the true story, the Fontana-based gang were surely participants in the infamous Hollister, July 1947, and Riverside, July 1948, motorcycle riots that were immortalized by Brando in The Wild One, the bike rider's answer to The Sun Also Rises. When the beleaguered American Motorcycle Association denounced an outlaw 1%, the proto-angels made that label their badge of honor. At a 1%ers convention in Fontana in 1950, the Hells Angels were formally organized. The Fontana Burdu chapter became the mother chapter with exclusive authority to charter new branches. The founding philosophy of the group was succinctly explained by a Fontana member. "We're bastards to the world, and they're bastards to us." Although Burdu continued through the 1960s as the nominal capital of outlaw motorcycledom, power within the Angels shifted increasingly toward the ultra-violent Oakland chapter, led by Sonny Barker, who also launched the group into big-time narcotics dealing. As Hunter Thompson put it, the Burdu Angels made the classic Dick Nixon mistake of peaking too early. There are two different versions of the story of their decline. According to Freewheelin' Frank, the acid-head Nazi secretary of the San Francisco chapter, Burdu was ruined by the seduction of the movie industry and a lawyer huckster named Jeremiah Castleman, who convinced them that they would become rich selling Hell's Angels t-shirts. In the other version of the story, they were driven off the streets by police repression. After the lurid publicity of a rape and two violent brawls, the Burdu Angels became the bête noire of LAPD Chief William Parker, who organized a posse of law enforcement agencies to crush the chapter. Establishing police checkpoints on favorite motorcycle itineraries like the Pacific Coast Highway and the Ridge Route, he generated such relentless heat that those few who insisted on wearing the colors, angel jackets, were forced to act more like refugees than outlaws, and the chapter's reputation withered accordingly. By 1964, when Thompson was slumming with the Oakland chapter, Fontana, heartland of the Burdu chapter's turf, had been essentially pacified. Local angels couldn't even muster a quorum for an outlaw motorcycle scene in a Sal Mineo movie. Some were in jail, others had quit, and many of the best specimens had gone north to Oakland. Despite its eclipse, however, the Burdu chapter never collapsed. A generation after Thompson's account, other angels are still bunkered in their Fontana redoubt, raising enough hell to force the cancellation of a major motorcycle show in downtown Los Angeles in February 1990, after a violent collision with another gang. Milltown Days. For able to win the nomination at Fontana, the public relations pivot of the McDonald administration would be a definite psychological victory. John Herling. After the turbulent, sometimes violent, transitions of the 1940s, Fontana settled down into the routines of a young mill town. The Korean War boom enlarged the Kaiser workforce by almost 50% and stimulated a new immigration from the East that reinforced the social weight of traditional steelworker families. The company devoted new resources to organizing the leisure time of its employees, while the union took a more active role in the community. The complex craft subcultures of the plant intersected with ethnic self-organization to generate competing cliques and differential pathways for mobility. At the same time, the familiar sociology of plant-community interaction was overlaid by lifestyles peculiar to Fontana's Millerian heritage and its location on the borders of metropolitan Los Angeles and the Mojave Desert. Although locals continued to joke that Fontana was just Aliquippa with sunshine, it was evolving into a sui generis working-class community. This is not to deny that there was a lot of Aliquippa, or Johnstown, or East Pittsburgh, in Fontana. Mon Valley immigrants ended up as the dominant force in United Steelworkers Local 2869. Dino Papavero, for instance, who was president of the local in the early 1970s, moved out from Aliquippa in 1946 because his father was worried about a post-war slump at Jones and Laughlin. It was widely believed amongst Pennsylvania steelworkers that Kaiser, in booming California, was recession-proof. John Piazza, Papavero's vice president and current leader of the Fontana School Board, first came to San Bernardino County from Johnstown, PA, as one of Patton's tank jockeys, training for the Sahara in the Mojave. While hitchhiking Route 66 to the Hollywood USO, he was intrigued by a billboard boasting of the opening of Kaiser Steel. After the war, he found himself trapped in an apparently hopeless cycle of layoff and rehiring at Bethlehem, which seemed to preclude any advancement up the seniority ladder. Together with other Johnstowners, he headed out to Fontana, initially living in one of the converted chicken coops, because Kaiser advertised itself as a frontier of opportunity for younger workers. These young Mon Valley immigrants quickly discovered that mobility within the plant or union in Fontana, as in Aliquippa or Johnstown, depended upon the mobilization of ethnic and workgroup loyalties. The oldest and most visible of local ethnicities were the Slovenes. Their community core, a group of Ohio coal miners who had amassed small savings, had come to Fontana in the early 1920s as chicken ranchers, establishing a prosperous branch of the Slovene National Benevolent Society, a large meeting hall and retirement home. Some of their children worked in the mill, although only informally organized. The Roadrunners from West Virginia and the Okies constituted distinctive subcultures within both the plant and the community. But it was the local Sons of Italy chapter, attracting streetwise and ambitious young steelworkers like Papavero and Piazza, that ultimately generated a whole cadre of union leaders during the 1960s and 1970s. Although the Southern California district of the USW in the 1950s and early 1960s, under Director Charles Smith and his henchman, Billy Brunton, was a loyalist stronghold of International President Donald McDonald, Local 2869, with its Mon Valley transplants, became a hotbed of discontent. Many Kaiser workers resented Smith's and Brunton's proconsular powers and ability to bargain over their heads in a situation where Local 2869 was far and away the largest unit in the district. In 1957, the rank and file dramatically registered their dissent by electing Tom Flaherty, local spokesman for the National Anti-McDonald Movement, the Dues Protest Committee, as president of 2869. After several wildcat strikes, the Kaiser management demanded that McDonald intervene to force the local to discharge its contractual obligations. Obligingly, the International imposed an administratorship on 2869 and deposed Flaherty and his followers. Although law and order were now officially restored within Fontana by the International's police action, the opposition was simply driven underground. By 1963-4, the older dues protesters, led by Joe and Minnie Luxich, had been joined by younger workers embittered by the wage inequalities generated by the new Fruits of Progress plan. To rub salt in rank-and-file wounds, the Committee of Nine who administered the plan virtually ignored Local 2869 and Fontana, preferring to conduct their deliberations in the more congenial setting of a Palm Springs resort. As a result, the situation deteriorated so badly in the summer of 1964 that the members picketed the Union Hall. Their signs read, USWA, unfair to organized labor, and equal pay for equal work. At this point, Ronald Bitone, former chairman of the Plant Grievance Committee, began to unify the different opposition factions around the national insurgency of I.W. Abel, a dissident official supported by Walter Reuther. In his history of the successful Abel campaign, John Herling described Fontana as both the gem of McDonald's achievement in labor management cooperation and the Achilles heel of his power in the West. On election day, 9th of February 1965, tens of thousands of pro-Abel steelworkers in the oppositional heartland of the Ohio and Monongahela Valleys nervously watched to see how Fontana, 2,000 miles away, would vote. Abel's commanding 2,782 to 1,965 victory within Local 2869 announced the end of the Ancien Régime. But at the same time, it warned of profound rank-and-file discontent with the textbook gains-sharing model. Within a few years, many Kaiser unionists would be as alienated from the reformist administration of Abel as they had been from the absolutism of McDonald. While Local 2869 was fighting to increase local control over the gain-sharing plan, The relationship between the company and the town was evolving in a very curious way. Despite the stereotype of being a Kaiser company town, Fontana was no such thing. When Fontana incorporated in 1952, the mill was left outside the city limits in its own low-tax county island. Not contributing directly to the town's budget, Kaiser lacked the despotic fiscal clout that Eastern steelmakers conventionally exercised over their captive local governments. Nor did a majority of Kaiser management ever live in the Fontana area. Unlike Bethlehem or Johnstown, no corporate suburb or country club district projected the social and political power of management into the community. Managers instead commuted from Gentile red-tile towns like Redlands, Riverside, and Ontario. The dominating presence in Fontana was, rather, the huge Union Hall on Sierra. Local merchants and professionals were left in relatively unmediated dependence upon the goodwill of their blue-collar customers and neighbors. Although never directly controlled by labor, Fontana government, as a result, tended to remain on the friendly side of the union. Yet, while eschewing direct control, the company still played an ubiquitous role in communal life. The location of the mill, far from big city lights, stimulated the organization of leisure time around the workplace. Kaiser's 1950s-60s personnel director, Vernon Peake, managed one of the most extensive corporate recreation programs west of the Mississippi. The internal structure of plant society was vividly reproduced in the composition of Kaiser's six bowling leagues during the kegeling craze of the 1950s. While hot metal battled cold roll in the no-nonsense Steelers League, white-collar bulb snatchers traded spares with pencil pushers in the Fontana League, and slick chicks edged pinettes in the Girls League. Like other steel towns, Fontana prided itself on Friday night smokers, and there were usually half a dozen pros and scores of amateurs training in the mill's boxing club. Roadrunners and Okies were especially active in the plant's various hunting and gun clubs, while others joined the popular fishing club. But blue-collar Fontana also enjoyed recreations that were usually management prerogatives in the more rigid caste order of Eastern steel towns. Golf was popular in some production departments, and leading union activists were frequently seen on the fairways. Other steelworkers took up tennis, joined the Toastmasters, became rockhounds, rehearsed with the excellent local drama society, or even moonlighted as stuntmen in Hollywood. Others raced stock cars, dragsters, and motorcycles, or simply spent weekends plowing up the Mojave in their dune buggies. Whatever the avocation, the point was that Fontana tended to see itself differently, as more egalitarian and open-minded, at least for white workers, than the steel cultures left behind in the valleys of the Ohio. Driving Big Bess Down. The Fontana plant has the potential to be competitive with any in the world. 1980. You can't melt steel in the middle of a residential valley profitably. 1981. Elliot Schneider, steel industry expert. Like every decline and fall, Kaiser's Steels was an accumulation of ironies. One was that the future began to slip away from Fontana, not in the midst of a recession, but at the height of the Vietnam boom. Kaiser was forced out of a rapidly expanding market. Another irony was that, although Kaiser executives in the last days would complain bitterly that Washington had abandoned them in the face of Japanese competition, the company had collaborated avidly with that very same competition in a vain attempt to restructure itself as a steel resource supplier. Kaiser was literally hoisted on its own corporate petard. After firing up its first basic oxygen furnace, BOF, in 1959, Kaiser Steel neglected plant modernization for almost 15 years. Having wrested the West from Pittsburgh, it ceased looking over its shoulder at the competition. In the meantime, Asian and European steelmakers were rapidly moving ahead with a technological revolution that included full conversion to BOF and the introduction of continuous casting. Kaiser fought the Japanese, its erstwhile protégés and main competitors, whose original plants Kaiser Made Goop had incinerated in 1945, with Pearl Harbor-era technology that included obsolete open-hearth furnaces, old-fashioned slab casting, 35-year-old blast furnaces, and dinosaur over-polluting coke ovens. Although Kaiser protested that the Japanese steel industry enjoyed unfair state subsidies, this hardly explains why its own investment program, the company was in the black until 1969, failed to sustain technological modernization. If Kaiser Steel squandered its once formidable technical leadership, it was because, unlike the more single-minded Japanese, it purposely diverted its cash flow into alternative accumulation strategies. In truth, Fontana and the other 50-odd Kaiser Enterprises were an unwieldy legacy. After Henry J.'s retirement to Hawaii in the mid-1950s, Kaiser Industries evolved as a family holding company with decreasing hands-on affinity for the world of production. Orthodox financial management, not heroic technical problem-solving, became the order of the day. From this basically rentier perspective, Kaiser Aluminum, with its consistently high profit margins, became the family's darling. Kaiser Industries' long-range planning focused on how to complement aluminum sales to the Pacific Basin with other primary product exports. When, in the early 1960s, the Japanese demand for steel began to soar as a result of the first stages of a Fordist home market-led expansion, Kaiser Industries, the major shareholder in Kaiser Steel, was more concerned about sourcing this demand with raw materials than with the future implications of expanded Japanese capacity for international competition. Specifically for Kaiser Steel, this entailed a fateful diversion of its plant modernization budget to purchase export-oriented iron ranges in Australia and coal mines in British Columbia. Eagle Mountain was also expensively remodeled, with an elaborate pelletizing plant added to process iron ore for export to Japan. Thus, years before U.S. Steel's notorious acquisition of Marathon Oil, with funds coerced from its basic steel workforce in the name of modernization, Kaiser Steel was restructuring itself with diverted capital improvements to export resources to its principal competitor, while allowing its own industrial plant to become obsolete. The Vietnam War, which jump-started the Japanese export offensive, dramatically transformed economic relationships around the Pacific Rim. In 1965, Japanese steel imports claimed a tenth of the U.S. West Coast market. By the war's end, a decade later, nearly half the steel in California was Asian-made, and the state was officially included in the Japanese steel industry's definition of home market. Kaiser Steel made large profits exporting iron and coal to the Japanese, only to see these raw materials shot back at them in the form of Toyotas and I-beams for skyscrapers. Together with U.S. Steel's Geneva Mill, still entirely open hearth, since USS's plant modernization had been concentrated in the east, Kaiser Fontana could supply barely half of Western demand, and they were constrained from adding capacity because of their technological inability to compete at cost with the foreign steel. Thus, the Japanese, and increasingly the Koreans and the Europeans as well, were able to confiscate all the Vietnam boom growth in Western steel demand. The so-called trigger price mechanism, adopted by the Carter administration at Big Steel's urging, only worsened the situation on the West Coast. Trigger prices were too low to prevent Japanese imports, and because they were calibrated higher in the East, they actually encouraged EEC producers to dump steel in California. In the meantime, Kaiser's vaunted labor peace was beginning to erode. Over the years, relations between workers and managers had calcified at the shop level, a situation that was exacerbated by the recruitment of truculent managers from Big Steel during the 1970s. At the same time, the incredibly complex formulae of the long-range sharing plan continued to generate pay inequalities that had already sparked protest in 1964-5. Workers retaining membership in the older incentive scheme were winning pay increases at a dramatically higher rate than participants in the general savings scheme, a trend which also aggravated intergenerational tension within the union. Likewise, LRSP remuneration seemed arbitrarily detached from individual productivity efforts. Faced with a new wave of rank-and-file discontent, the recently elected president of Local 2869, Dino Papavero, called a strike vote in February 1972. The resulting 43-day walkout was the first local issues strike, apart from the two 1957 Wildcats, in the plant's history. Papavero, who clearly visualized the import threat, hoped that the strike would be a safety valve, releasing accumulating tensions and paving the way for a new labor management détente. With the encouragement of the company, he launched a plant-wide quality circle movement in a last-ditch effort to raise productivity to competitive levels. Although workers cooperated in hundreds of improvements, management appeared to go along for a free ride, refusing to implement the broad capital modernization program that was necessary to save the plant. Moreover, there was the traditional dissonance between Local 2869's priorities and the International's goals. USW Regional Director George White, as always, concerned about the impact of Kaiser innovations upon Big Steel, opposed the work rule weakening precedent of the quality circles. He was supported, moreover, by Fontana rank-and-filers embittered by the long walkout and fearful of the loss of hard-won seniority rights and clear-cut job boundaries. In 1976, Papavero, the main advocate of cooperativism in the historic spirit of the LRSP, was defeated by a more confrontationist slate. The year 1976 was indeed one of bad omens. Steel profits had entirely collapsed, and Kaiser Steel's net earnings were exclusively sustained by profits from resource exports. The long-delayed modernization program, aiming at full conversion to BOF and continuous casting, was finally launched only to immediately encounter complaints about the plant's role as chief regional polluter. Since the 1960s, Fontana had emerged as the literal epicenter of air pollution in Southern California, and Kaiser Steel's huge plume of acrid smoke became indissolubly linked in the public mind with the smog crisis in the Inland Empire. The actual situation was considerably more complex. Aerial photographs taken by Kaiser during the 1972 strike, when the plant was entirely shut down, showed no abatement in air pollution. Moreover, many ex-steel workers still vehemently believe that the Kaiser pollution scare was purposely manufactured by developers who regarded the plant, smog spewing or not, as a huge negative externality to residential construction in the Cucamonga-Fontana area. As San Bernardino County's West End fell under the urban shadow of Los Angeles and Orange County, developable property values came into increasing conflict with a paycheck role of the mill as leading local employer. Inevitably, the pollution debate reflected these divergent material interests. While developers became strange bed partners with environmentalists in demanding a huge cleanup at Fontana, the Kaiser workforce joined with its management to protest the costs of abatement. As one ex-steelworker put it, "Hell, that smoke was our prosperity." In the event, Kaiser was forced to sign a consent decree with the Southern California Air Pollution Control Board that mandated $127 million for pollution reduction. This was more than half of the modernization budget. Partly as a result, from 1975 to 1979, while modernization was being implemented, the union was forced to accept painful triage. Capacity was ruthlessly pared as older facilities were scrapped, including the open hearth, the cold weld, pipe, and cold roll mills, and finally the original BOF. The inefficient and polluting coke ovens, on the other hand, were deemed too expensive to replace and were left intact. Fontana, in quiet anguish, began to bleed away its future. 4,000 younger workers, sons, brothers, and a few daughters, were laid off by seniority, with the company reassuring them that the new technology would restore price competitiveness. Local 2869 accepted partial decimation as a necessary sacrifice to save the plant and the community of steelworkers. When at last the new Kaiser Steel chief, Mark Anthony, launched the modernized facilities in an elaborate ceremony on the 9th of February 1979, he proclaimed the company's rededication to making steel in the West. But the new technology, including BOF2, the continuous caster, and state-of-the-art emission controls, proved cruelly disappointing. Startup costs were staggeringly over budget, and pollution from the antiquated coke ovens continued to embroil the plant in battles with local and federal air quality control agencies. In the face of this deteriorating situation, and with the vaunted modernization program near shambles, Anthony was removed and Edgar Kaiser Jr. personally took the helm, advised by experts from his family's investment bankers, First Boston. Although company publicists extolled the return of Kaiser Magic to active management, most workers were skeptical. Henry J.'s grandson was widely viewed as a playboy, more interested in his toys like the Denver Broncos than in saving California's ailing steel industry. Mistrust became rampant as the Kaiser family's real strategy was gradually revealed. Years later, Edgar Jr. confessed to an interviewer that, despite all the promises to the contrary, he had been sent to Fontana in 1979 by his father as a liquidator. "We were both in tears. I knew what it meant. Nobody else saw it, but I knew what I had to do. Break up a lot of steel. I sold off a lot of divisions of steel. My first day on the job was the prodigal son returning. I had to go out after 30% of the workforce in Fontana. It sure wasn't fun." The Kaiser family had, in fact, been engaged in negotiations with Nippon Kokan Keikei, the world's fifth-largest steelmaker. The Kaisers wanted the Japanese to take over Fontana while they restructured Kaiser Steel as Nippon Kokan's resource supplier. This was perhaps the inevitable consequence of the company's long-term bias towards resources rather than steel products. But to Oakland's consternation, Nippon Kokan did not take the bait, as expected. Instead, following detailed technical inspections of Fontana by its engineering teams, the Japanese giant politely declined Kaiser's offer. As Kaiser Steel ran out of cash and its stock plummeted on the exchanges, a second merger deal was hastily confected and put on offer to Dallas-based LTV. The negotiations collapsed in the face of the Volcker-Reagan recession, which plunged the U.S. steel industry into its worst crisis since 1930. On the West Coast, as explained in Chapter 5, local branch plant manufacture was swept away by a typhoon of Asian imports. At the very moment when Fontana's fate depended on an iron will to survive, as during Henry J.'s fight to pay off the RFC loan after World War II, the Kaiser heirs reached for the financial ripcord. The cherished goal of a resource-oriented restructuring was abandoned in favor of a staged liquidation of Kaiser Steel. In order to keep Fontana temporarily afloat as an attraction to potential buyers and to drive stock values up to assuage panicky stockholders, the Kaiser sold off the Australian ore reserves, the British Columbia coal mines, and the Liberian ore shipping subsidiary. Edgar Jr. withdrew as CEO in 1981 after, as promised, breaking up a lot of steel. The new managerial teams, after a few months of bravado about a crusade to save the blast furnaces, stunned the survivors of previous cutbacks with the announcement that ore mining at Eagle Mountain and primary steelmaking at Fontana would be phased out, while the modernized fabrication facilities were put up for sale. Barely 2 years after their ceremonious rededication, BOF2 and the continuous caster were being written off as scrap, a $231 million loss. Local 2869 mustered for a last stand, as best it could, but it had tragically few friends or resources. A desperate move to trade wage and work rule concessions for job protection guarantees was cold-shouldered by the company before being vetoed altogether by the International. As horrified members watched another 2,000 pink slips being readied, the local clutched at the final straw of an employee buyout, an ESOP. British Steel, long interested in finding a stable market on the West Coast for its unfabricated steel slabs, signaled that it was ready to consider a liaison with a restructured Fontana mill under ESOP ownership. Local 2869 retained the Kelsen Group as advisors and sent representatives to Sacramento to lobby Governor Brown and the Democratic leadership. In the event, however, Kaiser's intransigence about the ESOP frightened off British Steel, while government intervention on behalf of Fontana, or for that matter of any of California's floundering heavy industrial plants, was ruled out by Jerry Brown's new Entente Cordiale with the California Business Roundtable. Meanwhile, San Bernardino County leaders were divided over the implications of the closure of Kaiser Steel. Having boasted for years that Kaiser pumped nearly $1 billion annually into the local economy, they were anxious about the loss of so many paychecks. But apprehension was balanced by delight at the thought of rising real estate values and the removal of the county's principal environmental stigma. As a result, with the exception of pro-union Democratic Congressman George Miller, the local elites and politicos sat on their hands. In the face of this inertia in the local power structure, Local 2869's only remaining hope might have been a militant community labor mobilization against shutdowns that allied Fontana with similarly threatened factories and communities like Bethlehem Maywood, General Motors Southgate, or U.S. Steel Torrance. Unfortunately, there was no tradition of communication or mutual support between Southern California's big smokestack workforces. Moreover, the international unions and the county federations of labor tended to oppose any rank-and-file or local union initiative that threatened their prerogatives. When the rudiments of such a united front, the Coalition Against Plant Closures, finally emerged in 1983, it was too little and too late to save Fontana. At best, some of the survivors managed to float a life raft, the Steelworkers Old Timers Foundation, which has helped unionists deal with the bitter aftermaths at Fontana and Bethlehem.